In the movies, death is quick, final, and irreversible. In real life, researchers are discovering that death is not an all-or-none phenomenon. This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
The emerging field of resuscitation medicine is redefining death. Is it possible to revive a person who has stopped breathing and gone hours without a pulse? Could someone survive this experience and regain normal brain function?
Many people report profound out-of-body experiences after they're resuscitated. How can we better understand what's going on during this liminal time?
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, we talk with one of the world's experts in resuscitation medicine and find out how we can undo death.
First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Secretary of State John Kerry is attempting to gain support for a U.S. strike against the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad for alleged chemical weapons attacks. After meeting with the Arab League foreign ministers in Paris earlier today, Kerry said international standards on chemical weapons must be enforced.
All of us agreed, not one dissenter, that Assad's deplorable use of chemical weapons, which we know killed hundreds of innocent people, including at least 426 children on this occasion, this crosses an international, global red line.
The BBC's Hugh Scofield reports, despite Kerry's push for support from Arab League ministers, uncertainty remains.
Arab countries are divided on the question of military strikes on Syria. Some, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are in favour. Others, like Syria's neighbours, Jordan and Lebanon, are far more cautious, worried about the conflict spreading across their borders. This Paris meeting, arranged some time ago primarily to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, was a chance for John Kerry to hear the concerns of the Arab League on Syria, but also to make the American case again for armed action.
The BBC's Hugh Scofield. In Egypt, a committee tasked with amending the 2012 Constitution met for the first time today. Mary Kennedy reports.
As committee members take attendance at the beginning of the meeting, it's clear who is not represented. The Muslim Brotherhood, who dominated the 2012 Assembly and called this process illegitimate. Many groups are here that didn't have much say in the previous drafting process, like liberals, leftists, writers, and artists. Members elected Amr Moussa, a liberal politician and former head of the Arab League, as the committee's chairman. The three deputies are a former Muslim Brotherhood leader, a heart surgeon, and a lawyer. This is the first phase of the transition process that was set into motion when the military pushed Mohamed Morsi from power in July. Committee members say they're confident they can put together a strong constitution in 2 months, but some analysts worry that it's not enough time for meaningful change. For NPR News, I'm Merrick Kennedy in Cairo.
Fire crews battling the massive wildfire in and around California's Yosemite National Park are getting the upper hand. Officials say the rim fire is now about 80% contained. The average price for a gallon of gas rose just over 2.5 cents in the last 2 weeks. Fuel price analyst Trilby Lundberg says the upturn in gas prices stems from oil market concerns over the escalating conflict in Syria and the possibility that the Federal Reserve will start tapering its economic stimulus program.
This is the work of crude oil prices, which did get somewhat nervous about Syria in the past 2 weeks and because of perceived U.S. monetary policy.
The average price of a gallon of regular now costs about $3.58. This is NPR News. The International Olympic Committee voted today to reinstate wrestling as an event in the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. It had been taken off the program in February. The International Olympic Committee named Tokyo the host city yesterday. According to a report from the German newspaper Der Spiegel, the NSA and Britain's intelligence agency, GCHQ, have the ability to tap user data from the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Der Spiegel claims it learned about the practice through internal NSA documents. The BBC's Steve Evans has more.
Der Spiegel said its information was that the American NSA and the British GCHQ had set up teams for each type of smartphone to work out how to crack the codes meant to protect privacy. Having succeeded, the agencies could then read a user's contact list and lists of who'd been called. The documents Spiegel's seen do not show whether or not there has been mass surveillance of phone use. They do seem to indicate that the British and American security agencies have the ability to read private communications beyond what might have previously been thought possible or desirable by those who fear the intrusion of the state.
The BBC's Steve Evans. Police in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, say a 107-year-old man was killed by a SWAT team last night. They say officers responded to a call that the man had threatened two people with a gun at his home. After hours of negotiations, police released gas into the room and the man fired at police. Police returned fire and the gunman was killed. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Death seems like an irreversible event. When someone's heart stops beating, when they're no longer breathing, and there's a flat line on the monitors, it seems as if you've past a threshold from which there's no turning back.
But the new field of resuscitation medicine is changing all that. Researchers are revising fundamental beliefs about life and death and extending the time during which people can be revived. To find out how, we turn to Dr. Sam Parnia, Assistant Professor of Critical Care Medicine and Director of Resuscitation Research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His newest book is Erasing Death, the science that's rewriting the boundaries between life and death.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Parnia.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Dr. Parnia, let's start with the definition of death. I think it used to be a flat line on an electrocardiogram, no respiration, you know, sort of like, no, he can't fog a mirror. The pupils dilate and remain fixed, but you say it's more a process than a point in time. What do you mean?
Well, I think that it's important, actually, to start out with explaining that death, it hasn't changed. I mean, the definition of death remains as it has always been for centuries and millennia. And medically speaking, today, the way we define people as being dead is when the heart stops beating, and as a result of that, there's no blood flowing into the body, and therefore a person immediately stops breathing. And also, at the same time, brain function stops. And we know that brain function stops because one of the tests that we do is to shine a light on the eyes, on the pupils of the eye, and we find that the brain reflexes, so such as the reflex to light, pupillary reflex, are lost. So a person develops fixed and dilated pupils. But in essence, it's the three criteria of no heartbeat, no breathing, and a loss of brain function when a person becomes lifeless and motionless that essentially tells us that a person is dead. And that's the time that's used to define somebody as being dead in hospitals, and that's what goes on the medical records. However, the point that I think we are trying to explain to people now is that our understanding of death has progressed, particularly in the last 10 years. And now we understand that after a person dies, in other words, they turn into a corpse, as I've just described, it's only at that time that the cells inside the body start to undergo their own process of death. And although we used to always think that we have only 4 or 5 minutes before brain cells become permanently damaged and die, we now understand that actually brain cells can remain in a viable state for 8 hours or perhaps longer after a person has died. And I'd like to emphasize, we're not sort of playing with words. We're not sort of pretending that someone wasn't really dead. No, I'm talking about people who've really died, but it's the understanding that it takes a lot longer than we thought for the cells to decay. And therefore, we can now manipulate those processes and slow down the rate by which cells die and then bring back a whole person by restarting the heart.
Dr. Parnia, you start your book with an amazing story of a gentleman named Joe Tirolosi, who was dead for, was it 47 minutes?
That's right. I mean, there are now many cases of people who have been dead even longer than that, who are then brought back to life through resuscitation. And so what we are now thinking more is that death is actually reversible. And that's the important point that the book tries to highlight.
Tell us a little bit about Joe Tirolosi and his story, because it is very compelling.
Joe Tirolosi, I've come to know on a personal level as a result of him being a patient at the hospital. A wonderful man, was in his late 50s, was about 57 years old, in fact, when one day, as he was going to work, and he worked as a driver for a very well-known financial executive in Wall Street. And one day, as he was going to work, he started to feel unwell. He didn't understand what was going on. He pushed on. And within a short time, he realized that he couldn't drive anymore. He called a friend who was also a driver, who came and picked him up in the Upper East Side in New York, in Manhattan, and drove him to New York Presbyterian Hospital at Cornell. And as soon as he arrived, he basically collapsed and died. His heart stopped. He stopped breathing. His brain stopped functioning. As we've just defined, he reached the point of death. But luckily, he was in an area where swift action was taken, and a lot of measures had been put into place just around the time when this happened, where the hospital has procedures for cooling patients and preserving their brain. And to cut a long story short, he was essentially dead for almost 50 minutes while doctors tried to revive him. And luckily, the doctors persevered and eventually managed to restart his heart. And he now is a living, functioning person who's back with his family and is able to tell us his story.
Now, you say he was actually dead, dead by all measures, no heart rate, no respiration, dead for 47 minutes?
That's right. That's right. He was dead, for, as I said, for almost 50 minutes. And we have people who go beyond that for an hour and a half. That longest case report that I've seen, which I find absolutely astonishing, even I find astonishing, I should say, is of a woman who actually died in Japan and was left without any medical attention, essentially as a corpse, for maybe 5 to 10 hours. She was down for so long that her body temperature had dropped from 99 degrees Fahrenheit to about 68 degrees, which is obviously, as you know, when people die, their body temperature declines and they take up the temperature of the environment. And then she was found by a passerby who called ambulance, who arrived and started to do CPR on this woman. Clearly, they weren't successful. They couldn't resuscitate her. They took her to a hospital where they continued CPR, but again, they were not successful. Now, one of the most interesting things is that in Japan and South Korea, they use a system called ECMO, which is essentially a device that takes blood out of a person's body, gives it oxygen on the outside through a membrane, and then pumps the blood back around the body. And they connected this young woman, she was only 32, to this device, and they maintained her on that for 6 hours until eventually her heart restarted at about 2:30 in the afternoon. And then, to cut a long story short, she walked out of the hospital 3 weeks later, and I've been in touch with her doctors who've told me that in the last year she had a baby. And so the point we're making here is that death is actually entirely reversible, but it depends on the cause that led a person to die. Obviously, if we cannot fix the underlying problem, then it becomes futile. But if we can fix the underlying problem, then we can reverse death quite successfully, even many hours after it's taken place.
Well, Dr. Parnia, what accounted for the fact that this woman was able to be resuscitated after so much time? Is there an explanation?
Yes. The most important discovery, as I was trying to allude to in the last 10 years, is that actually brain cells take a lot longer than we thought before developing permanent and irreversible damage after a person has died. So in this case, this woman died by any definition you can consider. Yet her cells remained in this sort of viable state, in this gray zone, in which if resuscitation efforts were started soon enough, then the heart was restarted, then the whole person could be brought back to life again, as happened. One of the key discoveries has been that if we cool people down, and by that I don't mean to freeze them, I'm not talking about cryogenics, I mean, if we were to chill a person's body down, even from 99 degrees Fahrenheit to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, then that will slow down the rate by which brain cells actually die and preserve the body, preserve the corpse, so that we can then resuscitate them. So in this case, this woman died, but she died in a cold environment, so her body started to cool down fairly quickly, and therefore the cooling actually preserved her cells, such that by the time the ambulance crews arrived, maybe 5 or 10 hours afterwards, she was still in a potentially viable state. And then, more importantly, or at least as important, she hadn't died of a cause that was untreatable. So, for instance, if somebody like that had died from cancer that had spread all over the body for which there was no treatment, then, of course, restarting the heart would be futile because it would stop again and again. But in this case, she was a healthy woman prior to this incident, and therefore the doctors could resuscitate her.
And in both cases, both in the case of Joe Tiralosi as well as this Japanese woman, brain function was normal?
But brain function obviously was not normal when they found her, and it wasn't normal when they were resuscitating either Joe Tiralosi or this lady. But eventually the brain recovered to such a state that, you know, their brain function became normal.
Is there much resuscitation research going on around the world?
Well, unfortunately, resuscitation science is a relatively small sort of niche area. To put into perspective for you, if you go to the largest, say, national conference held in the United States for cardiology or pulmonary medicine, you'll tend to receive about, which happens every year, you'll get about 17,000 delegates, medical practitioners who attend. When you go to the resuscitation conference that's held once a year, you may be getting about 1,000 scientists and physicians who attend. So unfortunately, although research does happen, I think there's a lot more room, and it's a hugely underinvested area from organizations such as the NIH and other funding bodies. And the reason for that is that unfortunately, it's not as appreciated as it should be, because the perceptions are that you know, when somebody dies, that's the end. There's not much you can do, and therefore our support hasn't been what it should be.
You're listening to Dr. Sam Parnia, a specialist in critical care medicine and director of resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His newest book is Erasing Death: The Science That's Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death.
Those are some amazing stories about people who were dead for a long time and still were resuscitated.
A really long time. And the fact that they came back with their brains intact is pretty astonishing.
Well, we need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll find out how some people survived drowning for a surprisingly long time.
How can people survive death and still maintain normal brain function?
Since cold is important for survival, how do you cool people quickly?
Does your hospital have the capability to reverse death with the latest technology?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
I'm Lindsay Moon, producer at Illinois Public Media. Residents of Monticello, this message is for you. What makes Monticello a great place to live? We want you to tell your town stories using your video camera or one of ours. No experience required. We'll use your video stories in a special program for WILL-TV. Come to the We Are Monticello orientation meeting Thursday, September 12th at 7 p.m. at Monticello High School, or call 217-333-7300.
This week on The Evening Concert, it's the annual Bachfest Leipzig from Deutsche Welle Radio, then ballet music of Stravinsky from the New York Philharmonic. Wednesday, Joshua Bell is the soloist in Glazunov's Violin Concerto with the San Francisco Symphony, followed by Nino Rota's Trombone Concerto from our new series of Cleveland Orchestra broadcasts. Friday, it's prayer performances with Roger Cooper. That's The Evening Concert, Monday through Friday evenings at 7 on FM 90.9.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible by Red X Industries, makers of Utter Cream and Utterly Smooth Extra Care Cream, enriched with urea to moisturize dry, cracked skin. 800-345-7339, the website uttercream.com.
And by We Patients, where you can learn from others about possible triggers and potential treatments for your headaches or migraines, online at wepatients.com.
If you'd like to order a CD of this show, you can call 800-732-2334. This is show number 916. That number again, 800-732-2334. Or you can place the order at our website, peoplespharmacy.com.
Today we're talking about the new medical approaches that can undo death. Is it really possible for someone to be dead for several hours and still be resuscitated and able to think, walk, and speak normally?
We're talking today with Dr. Sam Parnia, Director of Resuscitation Research at Stony Brook University School of Medicine. Dr. Parnia is a specialist in critical care medicine, and he directs the AWARE study, Awareness During Resuscitation. His book is Erasing Death, the Science That is Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death.
Dr. Parnia, we have heard over the several decades that people have been interested in this whole area of research that sometimes people recover from drowning in very cold water. Children in particular who fall through ice, for example, and may be submerged for up to an hour or more can be resuscitated and have no loss of brain function. Is that the same basic mechanism?
You've highlighted a very important point, which is that, you see, and this is something I hadn't explained very well before, but most people who are listening to the program have a very fixed idea about life and death. And their definition of death or their concept of death is something that you cannot go beyond. So to most people, the idea that you can be dead and then be brought back to life again just seems incomprehensible. But the fact of the matter is that the reason we think that way, it's because of centuries, if not millennia, of thinking about death, which was that actually when a person's heart stopped and they died, there was nothing anyone could do. So whether they drowned or whether something else happened, they would be considered dead, and there was nothing anyone could do. But it's only advances in the last 50 years, and in particular in the last 10 years, that have begun to show us that actually death is completely reversible, and that our concepts about life and death need to be revised and rethought. Now, as I explained, one of the key factors that enables people to be brought back successfully after they've died is whether the body has been preserved through a process of being cooled. Because if the body is cooled, then the cells don't decay as rapidly, and therefore it gives time for doctors to go back and fix the underlying problem that caused the person to die. And if that is something that they can do, then we can bring back a whole person such as Joe Terilosi and send them back to their families and back to their life. Now, in people who drown, obviously, they classically don't have an underlying problem that cannot be fixed. They really died. They're healthy people who died through drowning. And they often are in cold water, and therefore the cold water preserves their cells. And that's why we have many case reports of people who've been dead for 4 or 5 hours in cold water or in water, who are then brought back to life successfully. In fact, our advances in resuscitation are such that if, and I'm sure we've all, most people have seen the movie Titanic, and that particularly that scene at the end where the rescue ship arrives and they find, you know, these 1,500 or so dead bodies lying in the water 2 hours after the ship had sunk. Well, if you think about it, those people were really dead. There's no doubt that they were dead, and anyone who's seen the movie would not, I think, doubt that. But if the ship, if the Titanic had sunk in 2012 instead of in 1912, then the vast majority of those people could have been brought back to life again. Because if you think about it, they died in cold water. They were mostly healthy before they died, i.e. they were on a ship, and they'd only been dead for 2 hours. And that's something that we can definitely salvage with today's technology.
How do you cool people? I mean, just out of curiosity, do you say, you know, bring on the ice packs?
Now, in terms of cooling, I mean, the most basic way of doing this, as you said, is literally, that's why it can be very cheap. It can be done in the third world, it can be done anywhere, is to take ice packs and literally put them around a patient's body and cool them. Now, there are more sophisticated technologies available, which, again, are not particularly expensive. To put into perspective, they're cheaper. than the cost of an ultrasound machine, just one single ultrasound machine in a hospital. But those machines will help us to regulate the temperature very accurately and then gradually warm patients up in a safe manner. And what we do is we put pads onto a patient's chest and onto their legs, onto their thighs, and the pads will then cool the body down and then gradually warm the person up. And that's how we do it.
Tell us a little bit more about that technology. What do you do to bring someone back after he or she has been dead for a couple of hours?
Well, resuscitation has advanced a lot in the last 50 years. Most people are familiar with the concept of CPR, and this CPR was really discovered by serendipity in 1960, where essentially doctors realized that if they were to compress the chest and to give breaths and to give electrical shock treatment and certain drugs, it's possible actually to bring people back to life after they've died. But for the first few decades after this was discovered, there was a slight blurring of the lines between life and death in the sense that we could bring people back for 10 or 20 minutes after they had died using conventional CPR. And so it didn't make as much of an impact on our sort of concepts about death being reversible because it was only for 10 or 20 minutes. Today, we obviously have to do CPR, and that's the first line treatment that we have available. But we now understand that it's very important to provide very good quality CPR, and that studies have shown that most people cannot even deliver that to patients. But one of the things that we now have are, for example, machines that we use that will give chest compressions to people who've died, but they can go on for hours, way above what any human being can do. In fact, there was a case of a man in London who received CPR for 3.5 hours after he died through a machine and then walked out of the hospital 3 days later, where in the past, such a person would have been declared dead a long time before. So once that basic stuff needs to be put into place. But now what we understand is that actually we can go steps further. That includes cooling the body down to preserve the cells and prevent them from getting damaged while we try to have other doctors fix the underlying problem. For instance, if someone's had a heart attack, you can now go in and take the clot out of the heart that caused the heart attack while you preserve the cells. And then as I explained, other technology that's really remarkable is that if we can use ECMO, this ECMO, we take blood out of the body, give it oxygen on the outside, and then buy ourselves 3 or 4 hours more time to fix the underlying problem while preventing brain cell damage. But the biggest problem with all of this is that while these technologies are available, and they're not particularly expensive, due to a lack of external regulation on the quality of healthcare that's being provided, these systems are not routinely available for most people. And it's nothing to do with which hospital you may be at, because even in the same institution or the same hospital, you can have different doctors who take care of these same patients in different ways, again, due to a lack of regulation. So at the end of the day, our chances of coming back from this are completely dependent on potluck. It depends where you end up, what day of the week, which hospital, which doctor happens to be there, and which unit, which hospital bed you're put into as to what treatment you will or will not receive and whether you end up coming back or whether you end up, unfortunately, developing permanent brain damage like Terry Schiavo.
Dr. Pernia, I can imagine many listeners are wondering whether their local hospitals have these capabilities. How would a person find out? And if you have the option of 2 or 3 hospitals to go to, as you might if you were in a large metropolis, how would you pick a hospital based on hoping to get someone who is experienced enough to be able to do this correctly?
Well, unfortunately, today there is no way to really do this because, and this was a point that I was highlighting, is that if you think about it, this is the only medical condition, by definition, that will affect every single one of us. Unfortunately, I will have a cardiac arrest. And I have to point out that a cardiac arrest is not a heart attack. A cardiac arrest is synonymous with death. It is death. It's just a medical term that we use for it. And as will everybody else. But however, we have very little control over that because I don't know when it's going to happen to me. An ambulance will be called and they will do whatever they do. So there's some variation in that quality there and then. And then they will take you to the local hospital that they deem is closest to them. And then you are obviously unconscious and you have no say in what's going to happen to you at that point. So without the implementation of high standards and quality from local states as well as the federal government, there is no way to ensure that we do get the best care. And that's why, again, I'm here on the radio talking with you, because I want to highlight this as a major public health problem. And that's also why one of the main reasons why I wrote the book.
It sounds almost as if the family might want to intervene at the moment that they arrive, for example, at the emergency department. Let's say that that Uncle Charlie is having a heart attack and, you know, in the emergency department, his heart stops. The family might say, well, you know, can you pack him in ice, lower his temperature, and try to restart his heart? Because presumably if they can get his heart working again, if they can do an emergency angioplasty, they might be able to preserve him just the way Joe Tirolosi was preserved and regained complete function.
Well, I agree with you in principle. I mean, I think that one of the things I've tried to highlight is that if you have a condition that can potentially be treated that causes a person to die, so heart attack is a very good example. A heart attack takes place because there's a clot that goes into one of the blood vessels. And by taking somebody to the cardiac catheterization laboratory, cardiologists who are skilled can actually remove the clot. Now, if somebody then dies from another condition that is unfixable, then, of course, we can't do anything about that. The problem, though, is that you don't want to end up in a hospital where the doctors are not familiar with how to cool and how to manage the cooling process, and then to try to insist that they should do that for your family member, because that sort of, you know, beats the objective. You need people to already be familiar and trained to do it. So that's one issue. But also what you mentioned really highlights something incredible that happened about a year ago in London, where, and I don't know if the people who are listening to this program happen to be, you know, soccer fans who watch the English Premier League, but I'm originally from England, so I do watch this. And during a live televised soccer game, a player in the middle of the game, about 20 or so, 30 minutes into the game, basically collapsed and died in front of the full view of all the spectators, the other players, and live millions of people watching all over the world. And the ambulance crews arrived and they tried to do CPR on him, and they continued for 90 minutes. Okay, so he was dead for 90 minutes. Now, incredibly, there was a cardiologist in the audience watching this, in this as a spectator, who ran onto the field. He somehow managed to get onto the field and tried to help the EMS crews to resuscitate this young man. And when they were taking him to hospital, he insisted that the ambulance crews divert from their usual protocol and not take this player to the local hospital, but drive many more miles and spend more time, but take him to his own hospital, it's called the London Chest, where he knew that they had cooling procedures in place and that he could regulate the cooling that the patient needed. So to cut a long story short, that's what happened. The ambulance crews luckily listened to him. They took him to that hospital. And consequently, his heart was eventually started. He was cooled. And a month later, he left the hospital. And he was actually physically well enough that he could have played soccer again. But what this highlights is that if this cardiologist hadn't been in that audience or hadn't intervened, then it's possible that this young man could not be here anymore because he would have been taken to a place where they weren't familiar with cooling, and he could have ended up either with permanent brain damage or just been a very sad statistic.
And of course, we as patients have no idea, you know, whether any of our local hospitals are doing this cooling and resuscitation.
Absolutely, we don't. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with what happened in New York City, but again, due to this lack of external regulation. Now, I have to highlight that it's important to cool everybody who essentially dies and has a cardiac arrest, but is then revived, their heart is restarted, because the cooling preserves their brain cells. Otherwise, the brain cells will continue to undergo damage. And the international medical guidelines give it the highest recommendation that it should be done. But unfortunately, studies here in the U.S. have shown that actually less than 10% of people, even as late as 2012, who were eligible for cooling therapy in hospitals actually received it. And so this is the big problem that we have, that without regulation, people will do whatever they're comfortable with, and it takes a long time for doctors to sort of, you know, all be on the same page and do the same thing for you know, of different specialties for their patients. And that's what we're dealing with. And in New York, what happened, because of this lack of regulation, by 2008, the EMS services, the FDNY, actually took it upon themselves to ensure that all the hospitals in the city had cooling systems in place. And what they did was they basically made a declaration unilaterally on their own that as of January 1st, 2009, they will no longer take a patient to a hospital who's had a cardiac arrest where they don't have cooling systems in place. And it was only this that ensured that every single hospital in New York City put together a cooling program, because they didn't want to lose out on receiving these patients.
Dr. Parney, would the cooling process that you're talking about also work for stroke patients?
If you think about it, when somebody dies, and I know that the concept of death is some sort of a personal or philosophical, somewhat even mystical idea to people, but from a medical perspective, as far as the brain is concerned, death is nothing more than a stroke, but it's a stroke that's affecting the whole brain. Because a stroke on its own is simply when a clot goes into one of the blood vessels that supplies a part of the brain, and as a result of a lack of oxygen and nutrients being delivered to the brain cells, those cells will die eventually over a number of hours. Now, when somebody dies, all that's happening is that there is a lack of blood flow into the entire brain, but the same thing happens to the cells. The cells will eventually die over a number of hours. Now, studies have been done where they've cooled people who've had a stroke. But the problem is, if you cool somebody who's had a stroke, in other words, they have a mechanical blockage, a clot that's gone in and blocked a blood vessel, cooling on its own is not going to be effective enough, because if you cannot dislodge that clot in time and supply blood back into it, the cells will all eventually die. It might give you a bit more time, but the cells will eventually die. And so that's where it has been ineffective for stroke on its own, because without the removal of the clot and resupply of blood and nutrients to the brain cells, they will die eventually whether they're cold or not, and that's what's happened.
You're listening to Dr. Sam Parnia, a specialist in critical care medicine. He's director of resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His most recent book is Erasing Death, the Science That is Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death. His previous book is What Happens When We Die.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll ask Dr. Parnia about his study of awareness during resuscitation. Why do some people report out-of-body experiences while most people do not?
For those who do have an out-of-body experience, what's it like?
What can we all learn from Dr. Parnia's research on resuscitation?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
This week in This American Life, Michael Lewis tells the incredible story of how a teenage boy made it into college, into Harvard no less, thanks to a stolen library book in another language, and real essays and emails sent to college admissions officers, including one from a parent that begins, "My second grader has decided on a career in electrical engineering. He is leaning towards MIT. As schools start, how I got into college, this week."
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids, Muhammad, Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, Thorpe Farms, Gibson City, and Prairie Boat Works, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Redex Industries, makers of Utterly Smooth Foot Cream with Shea Butter, helping dry, cracked feet feel soft and smooth. 800-345-7339. The website, uttercream.com.
And by We Patients, where you can learn from others about possible triggers and potential treatments for your headaches or migraines, online at wepatients.com.
If you'd like to order a CD of today's show or any other People's Pharmacy broadcast, the number to call is 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 916. That phone number again, 800-732-2334. Or you can find it on our website, peoplespharmacy.com.
We're talking about life and death today. The dividing line may not be as finite as you imagine.
You're listening to Dr. Sam Parnia, Director of Resuscitation Research at Stony Brook University School of Medicine. He's one of the world's leading experts on the scientific study of death. Dr. Parnia is a specialist in critical care medicine, and he directs the AWARE study, Awareness During Resuscitation. His new book is Erasing Death, The Science That's Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death.
Dr. Parnia, let's now turn to your study, the AWARE study. Tell us a little bit about what the goal is, what you're trying to do, how you're doing it, and then let's go back to Joe Tirolosi, because he's the case report that starts your book, and he did have an interesting experience during the time he was, quote-unquote, dead. So give us a sense of what's going on in this field.
You see, I'm an intensive care physician, and my goal, first and foremost, obviously, is to prevent people from dying. So whether someone comes to me with an infection, whether they've had a heart attack, whether they have had any condition that you can think of that leads a person to die, our primary goal, physicians like myself, is to prevent them from descending to the point where the heart stops beating and a person dies. However, in many cases, people do die, and we now have the means to bring them back. But in order for scientists, researchers like and physicians like myself to effectively bring people back and prevent brain injury, we have had to study the processes that occur in the body, and in particular in the brain, after death. So we have ended up stepping over the threshold of death for many hours, and we've studied what occurs there in order to prevent people from coming back as Terry Schiavo and hopefully come back like Joe Tirolosi. Now, a flip side of these discoveries and this research is that we have now gone beyond the threshold of death, as I've explained, for a number of hours. But we never forget that there's a human being in there, in that body. And we now know that people are able to go beyond the threshold of death and come back and tell us and provide us with first-hand accounts of what it is like to die, what one experiences, and what we will all experience, therefore, after we die. So in essence, what we study is, as part of what we study, I should say, is the experiences that people have at that point. And we now know that there are millions and millions of people from all over the world, sometimes children who are less than 3 years old, to adults, to whatever age you can think of, from all over, different cultures, different religious beliefs, or even lack of religious beliefs, who've had the same universal experience. And what they explain to us is that when they die, they become incredibly peaceful. Even if they were in pain before, when they have this experience, it changes, they become free of pain, they become incredibly peaceful. They see a bright, warm, welcoming light. They may describe a sensation of seeing deceased relatives, almost as if they've come to welcome them. They may describe seeing a being that is described as being perfect, full of love and compassion, who guides them through this experience. And they may describe a sensation of going to a place that is incredibly beautiful. And the whole thing is so incredibly touching for them that when they come back, they don't find that they have the right words to describe really what they experience. They try. Now, a proportion of these people will also describe a sensation of separating from the body and watching doctors and nurses working on them. And they'll tell us that they could see us looking from the ceiling, and they describe incredible details of what was going on in the room, conversations, people coming in and out, except that they're telling us things from a time when they were not only beyond the threshold of death, but also they had no brain function, because we know that within about 5 seconds, the brain completely flatlines after a person dies, and it also remains in this flatlined, non-functional state, even when doctors are trying to administer CPR. And the reason for that is because they can't get enough blood into the brain to restart the brain circuits. So, incredibly, we have these cases of awareness during resuscitation, and it was this that led to the development of the AWARE study, which again stands for Awareness During Resuscitation, where we looked at both sides of the coin. One aspect of this was studying the brain to see what we can do to improve delivery of oxygen to people after they've died, to hopefully preserve their brain. But the other side was studying their experiences and see what they recall.
Dr. Parnia, has anyone been able to actually check up on the stories that they're telling about watching resuscitation to see whether or not it coincides with what was happening in the room?
Well, one of the things that we have tried to do as part of the AWARE study, and the AWARE study is continuing because it's always going to basically continue as we continue to research the brain in people who've died. But one of the things we tried to do was to place some sort of independent objective marker, an image, shall we say, that could be used to determine if someone is really seeing what they think they're seeing from the ceiling. So we installed about 1,000 images onto 1,000 shelves that were planted in different hospital areas across 25 hospitals, where we thought it was more likely that people would have a cardiac arrest. And this is continuing, although it's evolving into a new method due to various findings that we've had. But one of the most interesting cases that we've had so far, which I've highlighted in the book in Erasing Death, is the case of a man who had a cardiac arrest in one of our hospitals in the UK, where we have absolute documentation that he had consciousness present for at least a 3 to 5 minute period. This is, you know, we've been able to nail it down to this period of time after he died, because he was able to recall not only events that were going on, but also independently had recalled how the cardiac defibrillator, the machine that they used to give electrical shocks, had given a recommendation to the doctors to actually give a shock treatment. So for those who are not familiar, there are particular devices out there that will analyze a patient's heart rhythm. And when a shock treatment is needed, it will actually give a verbal message to doctors and nurses where it says shock advised. And once this is done, then the doctors have to do CPR for at least 2 minutes, and then they have to stop, and then the machine will reanalyze the heart, and if a shock treatment is again needed, it will then say shock advised. So this patient was able to not only recall conversations and events that were going on, but also the fact that this machine had made this advice over at least a 3 to 5 minute period, which was also recorded in his medical notes. So it shows us that most likely after people die, their consciousness, their sense of self, does not become annihilated.
Now, a lot of people who are skeptics would say, but he wasn't really dead. He wasn't really flatlined. He was actually able to hear what was going on in the room because he wasn't really dead, or it was just a hallucination, an illusion, or perhaps a fantasy, or he made it all up.
Well, you raised a very important point, and I'm glad you brought this up, because, you see, CPR was first discovered in 1960, and it was by the mid-1970s that the first reports of people with these astonishing experiences were documented in a book called Life After Life by Raymond Moody. And the medical and scientific reaction to this was, by and large, of skepticism, as you pointed out, that these experiences are most likely hallucinations brought on by a dying brain, essentially due to a lack of oxygen or some other process. And I actually was very supportive of that hypothesis because I think it sort of made sense at the time. But people didn't really understand what we know about death when these theories were put forward. And what we do now understand is that after a person dies, as I explained, the brain completely flatlines. There is no brain activity when a person has died. And in order for you to hallucinate, for instance, if I were to give you LSD, and you may hallucinate by taking it, you have to have a functioning brain. If your brain is flatlined and you're dead, and you inject someone with LSD, they're not going to have a hallucination. So the idea that these people's experiences are hallucinations is somewhat premature, and it relates more to what we understood, you know, 30 years ago. But today's science tells us that actually it's very unlikely to be able to put this down to hallucinations for a number of reasons. One, there's never been a study that has shown that a lack of oxygen, and there are thousands and thousands of studies looking at the effect of lack of oxygen on the human body, lead to any kind of experience that's in any way similar to a near-death experience. The second is that we now understand that the physiology of the brain is such that the brain doesn't function. And in order to define something as being a hallucination, there has to be the subjectivity related to the experience. So in other words, if a patient comes back and tells doctors and nurses what they were doing, by definition, that is not a hallucination because he's describing real events that were going on. So the more modern way of thinking about this scientifically is that these experiences that occur to people give us an indication of what it's like to die for all of us, and that although some of us may not have had this experience, and it's up to us whether we believe them or not, nevertheless, they are real for those who've had the experience. In the same way that if a patient comes to my clinic and says that they feel depressed, I would never dream of telling them, well, you know, they're there, Mr. Smith or Mrs. Smith. I know that you feel depressed, but actually your depression is just an illusion. It's a hallucination. It's a trick of your mind because I don't believe that your depression is real. So we take human experience for what it is. When someone tells us that they have a particular sensation, we take that as real for the individual, and there is no way neurologically to try to verify or to refute the validity of someone's experience.
Dr. Parnia, 80 to 90% of the people who experience death, as you've described it, do not go through this afterlife experience that you're describing. Have we figured out why some people do have a memory of something happening or the experience of meeting a luminescent being, and why some people don't?
Well, this is actually a fascinating question you've asked me, and it's always intrigued us all as to why it is, as you said, that 80 to 90% of people do not have any experiences from this period after death, while only 10 to 20% do have experiences. And what's becoming more and more clear is that it's more likely that many more people, if not all of them, are having the experience. And the evidence that we have to support that is that if you try to interview people immediately after they've woken up from their coma, they will recall much more. But if you go back a day or two later, they tend to have forgotten the experience. And so what we are beginning to see is a picture where people are having this experience more commonly than we thought. But because interviews are being done later, then their recollection seems to have diminished. The other thing that we should bear in mind, though, is that when someone has had essentially a state where they've died and has been brought back artificially, the process of bringing people back actually leads to a huge inflammatory process inside the brain. The brain becomes swollen, becomes inflamed in a sense, really. And that actually has the effect of wiping out the memory circuits. And so it's much more likely that actually more people are having it, but because of this tremendous pressure on the brain after they've been recovered, their memory circuits are being wiped out. And so the way we're thinking about this more is similar to how we know that most people dream probably every night, if not very frequently. But somehow there's a break up of the memory circuits such that they can't recall their dreams the following day.
Dr. Parnia, as you review this whole area of resuscitation medicine and the goal of this book you have written, which is quite astonishing, Erasing Death, the Science That Is Rewriting the Boundaries Between Life and Death, what is it that you would like our listeners to take away from your research, your experience, and this important work?
I think there are a number of really important messages here. The first is that, by and large, for those of us who die through natural causes, although my job is to prevent that from happening, but I have to, have to accept that it's going to happen. But for those of us who die through natural causes, there is no reason to fear death. Many of us are afraid of death. But what these experiences now are telling us is that death is a very pleasant experience for the vast majority. The only caution I put out there is for those people who are contemplating committing suicide. That's an exception to the rule. But those who die through natural causes, whether it be heart attacks or strokes or accidents, whatever it may be, should not fear death. The second point that is coming out and is emerging from our work is that actually when a person dies, that the what we call the self, the mind, consciousness, the psyche, or the soul, there are different terms that are used to describe that thing that makes us into who we are, does not become annihilated. That actually it continues to exist, albeit in a hibernated state that we cannot see on the outside, at least for the first few hours after a person has died, which of course raises a profound and interesting question as to, well, does it become annihilated ever down the line, or does it continue? But certainly for at least the first few hours after death, it does not become annihilated.
Dr. Samparnia, we want to thank you very much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed coming back, and I enjoy it every time.
You've been listening to Dr. Samparnia, a specialist in critical care medicine and director of resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His newest book is Erasing Death, the science that's rewriting the boundaries between life and death. We talked to Dr. Samparnia earlier about a prior book, What Happens When We Die? You can listen to that interview on our website.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Russ Henry and Al Wodarski engineered the program. Dave Graydon edits our interviews.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible by Red X Industries, makers of Utterly Smooth Extra Care 20 Cream, with 20% urea for extra skin protection. The number's 800-345-7339. The website, uttercream.com.
If you'd like to order a CD of today's show or any other People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 916. That number to call again, 800-732-2334. You can also place the order at our website. It's peoplespharmacy.com.
And when you go to the website, you can let us know what you think about today's show and share your own story. Have you ever experienced an after-death episode? We'd love to hear from you. What was it like?
You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. If you have questions about prescription drugs, over-the-counter medications, dietary supplements, or home remedies, you can find answers on our website.
You may also wish to sign up for our free online newsletter. It comes twice a week, or the free podcast of the show. You'll never miss another People's Pharmacy program again. You can also share it with a friend. It's all there at peoplespharmacy.com. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you so much for listening today, and please join us again next week.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. Stay tuned. This American Life with Ira Glass is on the way. Students all over are starting college this month. Some of them still have a nagging question, though. What exactly got me in? An admissions officer tells the most wrong-headed things applicants try, and the incredible story of how a stolen library book got one man into his dream school. That's ahead here on Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana, and online at will.illinois.edu.